pleasure to be here. I always enjoy coming to the Abbeville Institute Summer School. I was here not last summer, but the summer before, talking actually on a similar topic, but focusing on James Henley Thornwell and Robert Louis Dabney in the context of theological literature. But I dealt a lot kind of with the topic that I'm going to deal with today on the older religiousness in the South. And that is a good place to start as far as a question. Is there an older religiousness that is unique to the South? And I believe that there is. And there's some really good articles out there that I would recommend that you read. A couple of them, one was written by Richard Weaver, called The Older Religiousness in the South. And also, A.J. Conyers wrote a really interesting article in the Southern Partisan years ago called The Real Old Time Religion. So I recommend those to you, and I'm going to refer to them as we go. Weaver's article, he makes three main points in his article, The Older Religiousness in the South. He says that the older religiousness in the South, first of all, is a revealed religion. It's based on revelation, based on a settled revelation. Therefore, it's really not subject to negation in the sense that Unitarianism, for example, is based on negation of Orthodox theology. It's based on speculation, abstraction, etc. The old religiousness in the South, Weaver said, is a revealed religion. Secondly, he said, it is a realistic religion. It's realistic. It has connection with philosophical realism. He talks about Scottish common sense philosophy. But his point there is that it's not overly speculative. It is realistic. It's influenced by philosophical realism. It's what you could say Alan Tate in his article in I'll Take My Stand would call the whole horse, not the half horse, but the whole horse. I may mention that as well. It's not compartmentalized. It's not mechanized. It's real. And then third, it was, Weaver said, reserved or not progressive. It was not based on ideology or progressivism. And because it was reserved, it understood its role. The older religiousness understood its role. It was religion and not politics. It was laissez-faire, thus not given to forced compliance or to centralized dominance. It was reserved. In a word, Southern religion was anti-modern. It was and is antithetical to the train of so-called progress. Now, Weaver does call, and I disagree with him on this, he does call it fundamentalism in his article. He refers to it as a fundamentalist, and I know what he means, but I think in the next lecture that I give, you'll understand why I disagree with that notion. Conyers, in his article, stresses that the real old-time religion, as opposed to the new religiousness that was dominant in the North and increasingly so in the New South, is number one, he said, incarnational. Incarnational in nature, as opposed to being overly nominalist, just based on words and abstractions. But it's incarnational. There's not an over-fixation on words at the expense of truth on the ground, community, reality, etc. Secondly, Conyers says that the old-time religion was harmonious. And he especially talked about its being harmonious in relationship to nature. He contrasts that with the Puritans, who saw nature as something to be conquered, an errand in the wilderness, nature as an enemy, so to speak, whereas the older religiousness was not out to domineer nature or to dominate nature. It was in harmony with nature. One of the most fascinating things that Conyers brings out in his article is a third point where he says that the old-time religion is mature in its anguish. And you think, what does that mean? Mature in its anguish. And I would refer you back to Alan Tate's Whole Horse. That's one of the points that he talks about, that old-time religion could deal with trauma. And that it had a certain relationship with passion and trauma that the new religiousness could not answer to. In other words, religion was not just for comfort or to make you feel good. It had a certain element of passion about it. Conyers goes on in his article and he says that there are three things that are really in opposition to this older religiousness. One, he says, is fundamentalism. I'm going to deal with that tomorrow. Second, Puritanism. And third, pantheism, or what he calls vulgar pantheism. Now, in order to talk about the older religiousness, I want to consider the new religiousness. Okay, because when you're talking about older, you're old in relationship to what? I think that the Puritans could be considered part of the new religiousness, maybe not in time frame to the American South, but in the larger context. But I think when you're looking at the new religiousness, especially as it relates to the South, the antebellum South, the key figure, the key transitional figure is a New England Puritan by the name of Jonathan Edwards. I believe that Jonathan Edwards represents the new religiousness in a way I think that a lot of evangelicals have not considered. In a way, he is a threshold of new religiousness. Now, Jonathan Edwards is hailed in modern evangelicalism and in the new Calvinist movement as the most trustworthy theologian. I was conversing with a Edwards scholar that we had invited to Liberty, one of the leading scholars in the world on Jonathan Edwards, and he talked to me about how there's a strong move among evangelicals to make Jonathan Edwards the sort of like their franchise theologian, the global theologian. Several are on a quest to make him that. One that stands out, you may or may not have heard about. If you run in evangelical circles, you probably have heard of John Piper. John Piper, who used to be the pastor of Bethlehem Baptist Church in Minnesota. He is one of the strongest modern enthusiasts for Jonathan Edwards that you will see. There's an interesting story that created a lot of controversy with John Piper in how he brought Rick Warren, who is not a Calvinist and who was sort of what you would say a very broad-based evangelical, wrote the book The Purpose-Driven Church and The Purpose-Driven Life, has that mega church out in California. And to the shock of a lot of the people, the new Calvinists that were following John Piper, John Piper invited Rick Warren to his big Desiring God conference, which is strictly kind of a Calvinist conference. This created an enormous controversy. In fact, I know some people who were big John Piper fans who pretty much cut him off after that because they didn't understand that. And they asked him, they said, "Why did you do that?" And his answer was, "I had a conversation with him, and when he told me that he had read all 17 volumes of Jonathan Edwards' works, I knew he was okay." In other words, he sort of used Jonathan Edwards as the standard as to whether or not he brought him in. Didn't matter if he actually believed and practiced a lot of things Jonathan Edwards said, that he cared enough about Jonathan Edwards to read all 17 volumes. And Piper, probably right, he said, I don't know many people that have ever done that. So he accepted him in. You can order in some of these new Calvinists. You may or may not be familiar with the new Calvinist movement, but it's a very powerful a movement in evangelicalism that is sort of a resurgence of Reformed theology within a lot of denominations. And you can, some of them have their own websites. You can order a T-shirt from one of these new Calvinist sites that says, Edwards is my homeboy. And has a picture of Jonathan Edwards on the front. Now, as I say, Edwards is a pivotal transitional figure. What makes him this transitional figure to new religiousness? For one thing, his philosophical roots. Jonathan Edwards drank heavily from the wells of the Cambridge Platonists, the Neoplatonic philosophy, Plotinus. He read Henry Moore and Ralph Cudworth. He was very much given to that philosophy, and you see it coming out in his theology. Edwards, in his theology and philosophy, sets forth a Neoplatonic-like idealism, where he says that spirit is the real substance of the universe, and matter is nothing but its shadow. For Edwards, physical objects existed only in the mind. They cannot exist unless they are perceived. Thus, all reality is an abstraction. All reality is an abstraction. All reality is an ideal. Edwards said this, quote, God is the only substance in the world. The only substance in the world. This is why Charles Hodge of Princeton University, the old Presbyterians, said in his systematic theology, and he liked a lot about Edwards, but he said that Edwards was essentially espousing pantheism when he said that. This is why Perry Miller, in a fantastic article that he wrote way back in 1940, connects Jonathan Edwards with the transcendentalist movement. That Jonathan Edwards was really a philosophical informer of the vulgar pantheism of transcendentalism that Conyers talked about. The point here is that Edwards represents, I believe, a stark departure from Christian orthodoxy. There's many good things about Edwards, and there's a lot of things I like about Edwards, don't get me wrong. But I think Miller and Hodge had it right in looking at the impact that Edwards could have. So he was clearly this transitional figure. Now I want to talk about one of the people that he influenced the most, and that would be Charles Finney. Charles Finney was really a protege of Jonathan Edwards. New Calvinists and evangelicals alike today, or the more reformed evangelicals, love to bash Finney. I love to bash Finney. I do it in a lot of class. I teach a regular course on revivals and awakenings in America, both on the graduate level and the undergraduate level, and we deal a lot with Finney. So I have a lot of fun with this because I have, you know, a good number of new Calvinists in my class, and they're all shocked to find that Edwards had a huge impact on Finney. There's a lot to, I think, bash Finney for if you're a conservative Christian. He is the wellspring of everything, it seems to me, or a lot of things that have gone wrong with modern evangelicalism. Things like decisionalistic evangelism, over-experiential evangelism, perfectionist theology, self-oriented posture in religion, formula-oriented religion, denial of orthodox doctrines such as original sin and the penal substitutionary atonement, of Christ. But what the new Calvinists don't seem to understand, and they usually, you can go to any of their websites or listen to their sermons, and they give Finney a hard time. But what they don't seem to understand is that their hero, Jonathan Edwards, was the major informant into the theology of Charles Finney. And this is a crucial point to see the connection between Edwards and Finney and then on to the doctrine of the older religiousness. There is an interesting article written by Alan Guelzo, and I wish he would stay with colonial religion and not get into Civil War things, but anyway, he wrote a really good article called An Heir or a Rebel? Charles Finney and the New England Theology. You see, the typical view is that Finney was an Arminian and he got his views from the Methodists, and that's just simply not the case. And Guelzo shows this very clearly. He shows that contrary to that popular belief, Finney got his theology from the new divinity Edwardsians. Nor was Finney a product of the West, who, like Andrew Jackson in politics, infused religion with experimental democracy. Finney was born in 1792 in Western Connecticut, the precise time and place where New Divinity theology was at its height. You had Nathaniel Taylor, Samuel Hopkins, Jonathan Edwards Jr., and so forth, Nathaniel Emmons, and others. And what these New Divinity theologians did is they soaked themselves in the theology and philosophy of Jonathan Edwards, and then they went in some different directions, even directions that Edwards would not have gone. And the New Divinity theologians, like Nathaniel Taylor, eventually began to deny original sin, saying that original sin was not taught in the Bible. And so Finney was born into this theological mix. He eventually lived in upstate New York, where there was a dominant presence of New Divinity Congregationalism and Presbyterians. In 1812 and 1814, he received a concentrated education in a New Divinity parish in Warren, Connecticut. And after his conversion to Christianity, he had become a lawyer, he received ordination in the New Divinity Oneida Presbytery. And the height of his revivalistic days were in the 1820s and 30s. In 1837, though, he moved to Oberlin, Ohio, and became a systematic theology professor and the president of Oberlin College. Oberlin, Ohio had been founded years before by Puritans from Western Massachusetts. They even had their own town covenant, just like you would have in New England. Finney was right at home. Now, there's certain areas I think you can pinpoint that Edwards influenced Finney on. One, a penchant for the emotional or the extraordinary. Edwards was much more oriented toward emotionalism, even radical emotionalism, than a lot of scholars believe. There's a really good article in the Church History Journal written in 2005 by Douglas Winarski called Jonathan Edwards Enthusiast? Where he shows, if you're familiar with Edwards' literature after the Great Awakening, he wrote a lot of things explaining what had happened in the Great Awakening in New England. And he downplays a lot of the emotionalism, and he criticizes a lot of the emotionalism, but what he doesn't tell you is that he was really one of the main leaders of some of the most radical revival, emotional revivals, in Connecticut and Massachusetts. And Winarski brings this out in a very powerful way. It's an article worth reading. Another one would be perfectionism. Now, Edwards himself did not espouse Christian perfectionism, but I think he sets the platform for the Edwardsians and for the Finneyites to adopt the doctrine of perfectionism. Listen to this that Edwards says in his work, End of Creation. Edwards wrote that, quote, "Elect creatures once converted are centered most perfectly in him and, as it were, swallowed up in him, so that his, God's respect to them finally coincides and becomes one and the same with respect to himself." In other words, when God looks at us, he sees himself. Now, I understand the doctrine of being in the righteousness of Christ and God sees the righteousness of Christ instead of my sin. This is more than that. This is an abstraction, a philosophical abstraction that can go in all kinds of really weird directions. And it's why, again, Hodge talks about Edwards dabbling and even being essentially pantheistic. And what this is, this doctrine of perfectionism, is a subtle form of divinization, of sort of divining yourself as being a part of God. And this is something that I think carries over into Finney and others. For Finney, the logic of perfectionism was clearly an extension of natural ability. Why should it not be? Man is not a sinner. He has the power of total surrender. Now, Finney believed that men sinned. He believed that men need to be converted. He didn't believe they were born that way, though. And he makes that clear in his theology. If one possessed a natural ability to repent, one possessed a natural ability to obey God fully. One of Finney's most famous sermons was titled, quote, "Make Yourself a New Heart." And he said in it, "It is self-evident that entire obedience to God's law is possible on the ground of natural ability. So that it is a simple matter of fact that you possess natural ability or power to be just as perfect as God requires." End of quote. You see, that's an anti-supernatural religion. That's a denial of the older religiousness of supernaturalism. He says the same thing in his lectures on revival. He says revival is just something that comes when you follow what he called the constituted means. You plant corn in the ground, you get corn. You plant squash, you get squash. You hold a revival and you get certain results. And he specifically says, quote, "A revival is not a miracle, nor dependent on a miracle in any sense." End of quote. Finney stated in 1839 that his doctrine of perfectionism is, quote, "the doctrine and has been of New England divines." A third area that influenced Finney from Edwards was conversionism, or decisionism, or an overemphasis on the act of conversion, sort of a revivalistic phenomenon. This is another area that New Calvinists really hit Finney on hard, that he is a decisionist, when in fact, a lot of that, I think, comes from Edwards. A fourth area would be the new measures. And this is one of the things that Finney's most famous for and was most criticized for, especially by the Calvinists, was his new measures, where he had an anxious bench for people to come up and think about their sins. Finney really invented the altar call. Now, I grew up in a fundamentalist church. I thought the altar call went all the way back to John the Baptist. But really, Finney invented the altar call, the new measure, planned protracted meetings, controversial preaching, calling out people in the sermon, and so forth. Listen to this. Edwards was, Finney said, a great man who was famous in his day for new measures. He got the idea of newness and new measures in many respects from Jonathan Edwards. Joseph Conforti has written that, quote, "The Second Great Awakening witnessed a kind of reinvention of Edwards." That's an amazing statement. Because usually scholars differentiate between the Second Great Awakening and the First Great Awakening. Ian Murray in his book Revival and Revivalism, a really good book, but he really creates that divide. You don't see a big connection between Edwards and Finney. But in fact, Edwards, through the New Edwardsians, is influencing Finney in a big way. Finney's new measures were controversial, not simply because they were new, but because they were measures of self-assertion, not seen on such a wide scale in American evangelicalism ever before. They were not so much about God as about self. They were not part of what we're calling the older religiousness, which is not about self. It's not about divinization. It's not about perfection. And it's not about dramatic results. It's something else. So what is this older religiousness? It goes without saying that older religiousness stands in contrast to what we've been talking about. But I would hasten to say that older religiousness that Weaver talks about and Conyers and others is not any one thing. It's more complicated than that. It's not even any one denominational viewpoint necessarily. It is, as Weaver said, quote, an attitude of orthodoxy. An attitude of orthodoxy. Absent the trappings that you see, I think, in Finney and Edwards and others. Now, like Weaver, I believe that this older religiousness precedes the Protestant Reformation. Now, when we're talking about the South, we're talking mostly about Protestants, to be sure. But you think of Alan Tate. He converted to the Catholic Church. And he talked about the older religiousness, but he said one of the big problems with the war was that the South didn't adopt the correct religion. Catholicism as the older than the Protestantism. Well, he has a right to hold to that, but I'm trying to deal with what actually was on the ground as far as the older religiousness that actually existed. And it was predominantly Protestant. But I do believe it precedes, as far as an attitude of culture, it precedes the Protestant Reformation. I think that's an important point. The carriers of this attitude, and I'm thinking more of the backcountry. I grew up in the backcountry of Northeast Georgia. So that's my people. I'm a Georgia redneck, I guess you could say. I probably sound like one too, but that's okay. There was an attitude, I think, that came in large measure from the borderland regions that David Hackett Fisher talks about. Well, that's not exclusively, but I think that's a big informant. And these were mostly Protestants. They were dissenters. Dissenters who had not, and whose religion had not been at the center of European power. They were dissenters not prone to mixing religion and political power. They had been the victims of that, see. They had been the victims of that. In fact, they were usually on the wrong end of religious establishments' power games. Thus, the machinations of millennial visions for earthly transformation and the general use of religion to control people was far from their minds. Now, I think Carolina is unique to this in many ways, and it goes all the way back to the colonial founding document. It never became the legal document of the colony, but it was essentially the founding document, the Fundamental Constitutions, written by Shaftesbury and John Locke. And if you've ever read it, you'll see that it is very much inviting to different religious groups. In fact, any seven people could come to Carolina and start a church. And they didn't even have to believe in Jesus Christ, as long as they said they believed in God. They did exclude Catholics in the Fundamental Constitutions. But that was a lot because of the conflicts, the European conflicts that existed. This was a medieval document. These proprietary colonies that come after the restoration of the Stuart monarchy, they are proprietary colonies, and a proprietary colony is really a medieval instrument. In all of the proprietary charters, you will see written on this, and I saw the fundamental constitutions. You can go to the archives in South Carolina and actually look at the actual one. And there it is, that all the eight proprietors shall have the powers of the Bishop of London. What on the, Bishop of Durham, sorry, the Bishop of Durham. What on earth is that? Well, the Durham was northern England, and there always needed to be a buffer zone between England and Scotland, and the Roman Catholic Bishop of Durham had extraordinary powers. And so, and this is in the 1000s, this concept of the Bishop of Durham. It carries all the way over into the colonial charters. So a proprietary colony like South Carolina is a medieval instrument. And the religious makeup in many respects was decentrist and medieval and in the earth, not an abstraction per se. So this older religiousness in the South, what are some things other than, and we might overlap a little bit with what Weaver talked about and what Conyers talked about, but I want to just sort of throw some labels out there that I think help describe this older religiousness in the South, this attitude of orthodoxy that even precedes the Protestant Reformation. One is that it is decentrist. And the medieval ethos really lends itself to, feudalism by its very nature is a decentrist system. In Europe at one time there was as much as 1,000 different political units. So it wasn't given to overt centralization. And I think that idea, that concept comes in to the religious structure in the South. It's non-rationalistic, or I should say not overly rationalistic, not given to overmuch speculation. It's not given to a rationalism that replaces the miraculous. In other words, it's not a half-horse religion. Now, this does not mean that they did not care about reason or reasoned faith. Key examples of theologians who used logic well are people like Thornwell, Dabney, Benjamin Palmer, James Boyce, John Broadus, some of the greatest Christian theologians that America has ever produced came out of the South. And they were careful thinkers. Religion was not just a matter of emotion to them. It was a reasoned faith. But there's a difference between being non-rational and irrational. There's a difference. Or unreasonable. Another label of the older religiousness is that it was theocentric, not anthropocentric. Or not man-centered. As we have seen, the new religiousness had a certain focus on self instead of God. The opposite is true with older religiousness. Puritanism, even early Puritanism, had a strong strain of this new religiousness, as I mentioned. If you want to see this, read Richard Weaver's article, Two Diarists, where he compares Cotton Mather and William Byrd. And William Byrd comes out looking good. And to be honest with you, that's doing something, in my opinion, because William Byrd could really be a bird, so to speak. But he compares these two people that you wouldn't think would serve an article of comparison, and he shows how that Mather's religious life derived from some curious, and this is a quote from Weaver, some curious extrapolation of the importance of the self. At any rate, Mather appears consumed with the idea of his own personal importance to God. And he quotes this over, this mantra of statements that Cotton Mather gives, that he's going, God has some great work for him to do in the world. And it's sort of, he's fixated on that great work. This pietistic, puritanical self-focus, there's some really interesting examples. I just mentioned Cotton Mather's sort of complex being at the center of attention. Or you could say Jonathan Edwards, his excessive reliance on affections. He wrote a book called Religious Affections, in many respects very good. But an overemphasis on feelings and affections as the barometer of one's salvation and one's spirituality instead of the written promises of the Bible. Or you could look at the sad incident of Edwards' own uncle, who slit his throat because he could not seem to attain the assurance of salvation. Killed himself. Now, I would say that's not a good thing to do. If you're trying to find assurance of salvation, you don't want to kill yourself. Or to the earlier Puritan, Michael Wigglesworth. I've talked about him a few years ago, but it's too good to leave out, so I'm going to bring it up. Michael Wigglesworth, the Puritan who obsessed about a lot of things. One of his children got badly burned, and he felt like he should be emotionally detached because it would be sinful if he showed too much affection for her. Or he had this fear, and he was a lot of times repenting of the sin of flatulence. You know, he couldn't understand that, why he had to do that. Now, I like Augustine's approach to that. He actually deals with that in the City of God. I don't know if you know that. This is a side note, but I think it's instructive to counterbalance Wigglesworth's negative view of flatulence with Augustine's. In the City of God, Augustine discussed some of the physical things that men could do that amazed him. And quote, this is Augustine, "We do in fact find among human beings some individuals with natural abilities very different from the rest of mankind and remarkable by their very rarity. A number of people produce at will such musical sounds from their behind without any stink that they seem to be singing from the region." Or you could take Luther's, there's this famous woodcut of German peasants dropping their pants and flatulating on a papal bull. You know, I know that's offensive, especially to a Catholic, but the point I'm trying to make is that they didn't overly, think of this as, some deep, dark sin, because it was a natural part of the body. But Wigglesworth did. Maybe Augustine understood incarnational theology better than Wigglesworth. And that brings me to the next point. The older religiousness was incarnational and not overly nominalist, not an abstraction. Alan Tate said, "Abstraction is the death of religion." I think that's right. Now, by incarnational, I mean that the Word of God lived out in community brought the real and deeper meaning to the Scriptures and to faith. And there's a really good statement by Wendell Berry in his recollected essays, in his essay called The Body and the Earth. Listen to this. And this illustrates, I think, incarnational theology. "The question of human limits, or the proper definition and place of human beings within the order of creation, finally rests upon our attitude toward our biological existence, the life of the body in this world. What value and respect do we give to our bodies? What uses do we have for them? What relation do we see, if any, between body and mind, or body and soul? What connections or responsibilities do we maintain between our bodies and the earth? These are religious questions. Obviously for our bodies, are part of the creation, and they involve us in all the issues of the mystery. And I think that nicely sort of explains that. But I want to hasten to another point. I think that the older religiousness had a certain balance, however, and it was careful not to be overly incarnational. In other words, it was otherworldly in a good sense. Or you might say it was not overly transformational. It was not about, you know, just always transforming the world. The older religiousness in the South was not overly incarnational or transformational. Religious expressions that overindulge the concept of incarnational faith tend to become unduly focused on the earthly transformation of society and government. This is when an unhealthy mixing of the church and government, I think, ensues. A too entranced incarnational focus can lead to an aggressive millenarianism and an unfortunate mixing of the city of God and the city of man. When church and society are one and the same to the point that politics gets in the driver's seat, it is never an unhappy outcome. Never. And that's where I think there's room for caution. Another signpost, we'll say, of this older religiousness is that it's obviously, and this is very obvious, it's traditional. It's not progressive. I have some things I wanted to say about that, but I'm going to skip it. And just, I'll recommend you to Weaver's Ideas Have Consequences, because I think that really encapsulates this the importance of tradition to the faith. Another one, it is tolerant and not domineering. In no other religion of the world have different religious denominations coexisted more peacefully than in the South. There has been, and to a large measure still exists, a high level of mutual respect in the South for differing religious views. This is real pluralism, not the contrived and legislated pluralist tolerance so prevalent in today's liberal culture. This is a principled pluralism, whereby differing parties do not surrender their views. After all, they have an attitude toward orthodoxy, but honor their neighbor's right to hold and express opposite views. The older religiousness is also confessional. I know there's exceptions to this, but I think there is an underwriting confessional background to older religiousness. Confessional and not overly conversional. Now, I think this contrast is a key difference between old religion and new. If you look at even some of the early Puritans, Calvin, you can hardly find a conversion experience in anything Calvin says. And that's not to denigrate the idea of conversion. I had a conversion experience. But the point I'm trying to make is that it cannot be the focus. The experience cannot be the focus. It needs to be on the confession, on the creed, on what you believe. I think the Puritans had a strong strain of German mysticism that really influenced them toward an overemphasis on the conversional, to the point where belief in Christ, trust in Christ, believing the gospel was not enough for salvation. There had to be a dramatic experience of conversion, interviewing the people to see if they had had this conversion. This is eventually, what got Jonathan Edwards kicked out of his church. He placed so much emphasis on trying to determine if people within his church were converted, they really got tired of it and dismissed him from his church. Conversion, of course, is central to the First and Second Great Awakenings. Now, hearing me talk, you may think that I really don't like the awakening. I just finished a book on the Great Awakening in Colonial South Carolina. I love to study awakening theology, and I love a lot of, I think they're great, Christian men in many respects. But I have to look at it from a certain perspective that I think where I see some dangerous elements. So this emphasis on a dramatic experience of conversion to verify the belief. If you ask most any scholar, what is the definition of evangelicalism? The first thing will be that a person has a conversion experience. And this is not to say that great Southern divines did not preach or believe in conversion. They did. But it is to say that there was not an over fixation on the experience of conversion. Belief was the pressing matter. Not how and when or under what circumstances you believed. The older religiousness also is agrarian, not industrial. It's not a slave to the instantaneous. It has a virtue of patience. It does not depend on political machinations. It is agrarian. There's a lot of things I wanted to say about that. Good quote from Wendell Berry, but I'm going to skip it to move on. The older religiousness sees nature as a gift of God, not as a trap of the devil. And I've already talked about that. Now, I want to give you one that you may disagree with, but may make it a fun conversation. And this is in disagreement with Conyers in his article. And that is that the older religiousness takes a literalist view of the Bible. Now, that is contrary to what most people will say. But let me explain what I mean. This is an area where I think, as I say, Conyers is not altogether accurate. He argues that literal interpretations had little sway in old-time Southern religion. And he seems to label all inerrantists as fundamentalists. Older religiousness, however, has historically adhered, I believe, to a reasoned type of biblical literalism, but was never a slave to it. There is a radical type of literalism that even takes figurative speech literally. But anybody knows that certain things are written figuratively, and I don't know anybody. I've never met even a fundamentalist that would not agree that there is figurative language in the Bible. I find that rare among most anybody. Listen to what Wendell Berry says. Now, this is interesting. In his essay, The Burden of the Gospels, he said, "I need to say that as a reader of the Gospels, I am first of all a literalist, as I think every reader should be. This does not mean that I don't believe in higher levels of meaning. It certainly does not mean that I think every word of the Bible is equally true." I disagree with him there. "Or that literalist is a synonym for fundamentalist. I mean simply," and I like this, listen to this, "I mean simply that I expect any writing to make literal sense before making sense of any other kind." Now, that's powerful. Literal sense before, in other words, it's not about abstraction and ideology. That's what he's saying. Another one, and this is the last one, the older religiousness was generally amillennial or postmillennial, not premillennial. But I'm going to talk about that tomorrow in my discussion on fundamentalism. When we think of an older religiousness, evangelicals like me are tempted to think that the new religiousness is something akin to modern liberalism, because I'm conditioned by the fundamentalist modernist debates and studying them. That's how I think in those black and white terms. But in truth, one of the best and most subtle forms of new religiousness is, in fact, fundamentalism. And its offspring, modern evangelicalism, both of which evolved in many strains from Edwards, Finney, and company. Now, it's not easy for us in modern times to relate to or even recognize this older religiousness. But I do believe its vestiges are still with us in the lives of sincere believers. I'm not sure I can identify this older religiousness in any one denomination or movement. It seems to me, though, that its tenets are embedded, if hidden, in our core consciousness as Southerners. Like beauty, we might have a hard time defining it, but we recognize it when we see it. It is there just as sure as an old Southern culture is still with us. Our job, I think, is to recognize it where we see it and cultivate it where we can. Thank you.
Away down south in Dixie.